It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios Maria Tomczyk, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
No job this morning?
No job. He was a little bit sick yesterday, and he decided to sleep in this morning.
All right.
And take care of whatever he might be coming down with.
Yeah. Well, we want him to take care of that.
Yeah. Preemptive strike
on those nasty bugs.
The only acceptable preemptive strike.
All right. So, Christine Gregoire keeps her hopes alive for going back to the governor's office one of these days.
Yes, the Democratic Party came up with the down payment for a recount. And, excuse me, they were initially going to do a partial recount just in the counties where Gregoire had most of her support. And then she actually came out and said, if we're going to do a recount after a lot of, excuse me, after a lot of newspapers and pundits weighed in and said, oh, if you're going to do a recount, it should be a full recount. She came out and said that, yes, if they were going to do a recount, that she would prefer it be a full recount. And the Democratic Party has said, yes, okay, here's the down payment for a full recount. And Dino Rossi, of course, the Republican candidate, and his supporters are all up in arms. They are unhappy because he was certified last week, I believe, by the by Sam Reed, and he should be going to Olympia in their eyes. But it's really the state legislature that certifies the governor's candidate, the candidate for governor, when the legislature convenes in January. So there is still time for Gregoire to win the election, even though most folks are thinking that she's not going to.
Well, and with our mm-hmm. state legislature and the time it takes them to come up with some decisions, man, that could be years.
Yeah.
So.
Well, no. I mean, that's usually a formality, voting on the governor's candidate, on the governor candidate. So we'll see. We'll see. Right now, there is some question about who's going to be governor and what effect that's going to have on the budget, because Gary Locke came out this week and he said that while he's been drafting the budget, his last act as governor is to draft the budget for next year for the legislature to make changes to, et cetera. He's saying that while looking at a preliminary look at the figures shows that there's going to be about a $1.6 billion deficit. Now, depending on who's governor, we're going to see how that deficit is filled. It could be cuts again. Dino Rossi and his folks prefer that there be no new revenue stream, so no increase in taxes. They would like to just cut as many services as they can in order to get to that balanced budget. Christine Gregoire has left the door open for a potential tax increase to cover that deficit. Now, we should also put this in the perspective of the last 2 to 3 years. The budget has taken cuts that total about $4 billion. So there really isn't a whole lot left to cut. Right now, you're down to the basics, like cutting the basic health care plan, cutting dental services for low-income people, you know, that sort of thing. The sort of thing that makes these cuts really particularly painful. So if Rossi is governor, we're going to see some essential services under the axe. If Gregoire does pull it out of the bag and become governor instead, we may see some tax increase. But again, it's going to be a fight over what kind of tax increase. And with the legislature not being able to agree on a transportation package for the last 4 years, it'll be interesting to see whether they can agree on a tax increase plan if Gregoire does become governor.
Well, sticking with news from within the state for a minute more, the citizens overwhelmingly supported Initiative 297 for Hanford this mm-hmm. Last election.
Yeah, to clean up Hanford and to block the Energy Department from sending any more waste to Hanford. They had a plan. They wanted to send transuranic waste to Hanford to be packaged up for disposal. Transuranic is the really highly toxic waste, the stuff that is usually involves plutonium, the very, very, very toxic stuff. And it's usually things like tools and gloves and that sort of thing that have been contaminated with plutonium. And the citizens of the state of Washington said by an overwhelming majority, a two-thirds majority, that no, don't send us any more waste here in Hanford. Now, the feds, of course, looked at that and they said, no, we can't have states trying to legislate what we do with nuclear waste. And so they decided to challenge the initiative in court. And a federal judge this past week put a hold on the initiative going into effect. It was supposed to go into effect earlier this week. It's been delayed because of this court order. Now, at the same time, there are other lawsuits that have been working their way through the court to block waste shipments into Hanford. And right now, there's a hold on any new waste coming into Hanford. So although the initiative isn't being allowed to take effect yet, there isn't any waste being shipped into Hanford. And this initiative is sending a signal to the feds that the people of the state of Washington want some say in what happens in Hanford, even though it's a federal site. They're saying, look, clean the place up. You can't bring us any more waste. You know, we're not going to deal with it. So even though the initiative itself was blocked, the federal government is trying to override what was the most popular initiative in our last election. Still, we have the tool of the courts that have placed not just a hold on the initiative, but are also, through other lawsuits and other means, are placing a hold on any kind of shipment of waste into Hanford so far. But we should keep an eye on this and make sure that the feds don't completely overrule it.
Yeah, the judge in that particular situation, Judge McDonald, I can't remember his first name. Anyway, he's been involved with a lot of the downwinder cases, and he hasn't been very receptive to
the
downwinders, and so he's it's not a good sign from that standpoint of picking that particular judge.
Yeah, and this is in a climate where the Bush administration is trying to promote the use of nuclear power as a clean way to deal with global warming. I think that's highly ironic, given the fact that we here in Washington State, in particular, know how unclean nuclear power can be.
Dirty.
Yeah.
All right. Jump into national news and popping back to that concept of the economy. I know that you were up first thing on Friday morning after Thanksgiving to get out there and hit those sales.
No. Actually, the day after Thanksgiving, I usually spend the whole day recovering from seeing my family the day before. So, no, I don't usually go out and spend anything the day after Thanksgiving. And that's actually a good habit, I think, for most folks. However,
it's buy nothing day for
those of us who follow that kind of thing. The rest of the population, however, they do give in to the enormous amount of advertising that goes on right up to Thanksgiving Day, saying, come out for the sales the day after Thanksgiving, you know, a day that most people do have off from work and use it to start their Christmas shopping. Now, there was, if anybody was paying attention to the news on the day after Thanksgiving, they would have heard these fantastic news stories or these fabulous news stories about, oh, the enormous numbers of shoppers in the mall in the morning after Thanksgiving, and they would have seen the videotape of people fighting to get into Walmart and Kmart and places like that. And then they would have been surprised in the next couple of days to hear the news stories about how the Thanksgiving weekend was not a very good shopping weekend for retailers. And it's funny because those early morning sales that are meant to draw people into the stores and keep them there all day drew in a lot of people who found bargains earlier in the day, and then when the bargains ended at around 11 in the morning or noon, those people stopped shopping. What that tells you is that people who are used to buying lots and lots of gifts for their kids for Christmas and for their family members and friends, those folks don't have the same amount of disposable income that they've had in past years. They're only buying when the deals are really, really good. What that says about our economy is that we're reaching the end of people's ability to finance their big consumption. So people are borrowed to the hilt. A lot of people are out of work. A lot of folks are finding it hard to make the mortgage payments and the car payments, and they're holding back. They're not spending like they have in past years. That's a problem, not just for our economy here in the U.S., but for the global economy. What's been driving the global economy for the last, I'd say 8 to 10 years, is that the United States, well, in particular in the last 3 to 4 years, the United States has been the consumers of last resort. We're the people who buy up the goods made everywhere in the world. that's what it means when you when you hear statistics like the U.S. has a record trade deficit. What that means is people in the United States have borrowed to the max, and they've been buying the goods that other nations ship, export to us, that the United States imports from abroad. We are the consumers of last resort. And so we buy the goods that everybody else produces. In turn, in order for us to get the money to do that, we have to borrow and borrow and borrow and borrow. Now, that includes the federal government. Has to borrow and borrow and borrow and borrow to be the consumer of last resort for the world, too.
Four borrows.
Yeah. And in order to do that, the U.S. government and banks, global banks, issue lines of credit. They give credit cards to people. The U.S. government issues bonds and treasury bills. And the people who put up the money for those things are foreigners, more and more. It's not wealthy Americans that are doing it. It's foreign banks, in particular banks in Japan and Asia, in China, places like that, in Taiwan, Singapore. Those guys have been buying up a lot of the U.S. debt. So that means they hold a lot of dollars in their banks. Now, the problem is that their folks are not spending a lot of money. They're saving a lot of money. They put their money into these Japanese banks, et cetera, the Japanese banks, the Taiwanese banks, the Singapore banks, the Chinese banks, et cetera, take the savings of their populace, and then they loan it to Americans. That's pretty much how our consumption has been fueled. Now, the problem is that eventually the citizens of Japan and China and Taiwan and Singapore and their banks are going to start saying, is the dollar a good investment? You know, loaning to U.S., to the people of the U.S., is that a good investment? And that's starting to happen now. In fact, Alan Greenspan came out and he said there's going to be a limit to how much money Asian banks are going to want to lend us anymore. And they're going to start looking for better investments somewhere else, things that have a higher rate of return. And what he means by that is because the interest rates are so low in the United States, and the interest that anyone gets on buying U.S. Treasury bonds and U.S. Treasury bills and bonds, corporate bonds here, which finance banks here in the United States, the interest rate is so low that foreign investors are going to start asking themselves, shouldn't I be investing in something that has a better rate of return? And when that happens, you start having problems. And one of the early indicators of that was the falling value of the dollar. That means people are selling the dollar. They're not buying the dollar the way they have been in the past. And if the dollar starts to drop precipitously, then you'll know that foreign banks and foreign governments and foreign investors are starting to sell it at a high rate and starting to invest in something else. So that's a problem. When you've got the U.S. economy, when you've got people here in the U.S., not being able to borrow anymore and not being able to finance their consumption anymore, you can start to see the end of that cycle. And it's when these cycles end and begin to shift that things become very unstable. So we'll have to see what happens in the next few months. See how that's going to fall out for not just the U.S. economy, but for the global economy in general. It'll be kind of interesting.
All right, so we'll see which direction the roller coaster sends us in.
Yeah, up or down,
or to the side,
or to some other little side spur we didn't anticipate.
Or throw you completely out of the car. Well, one of the countries you just mentioned was China, and I understand they negotiated some deals last week.
China's been doing some interesting things. Now, one of the things about the Bush administration is that George Bush doesn't understand any of this economic stuff, quite obviously. He has to sit down with all of his economic advisors who are changing on a routine basis. I think I found it kind of funny that among the cabinet changes that have been happening in his administration, that he's cleaned out his economic team yet again. He cleaned it out about halfway through his first term when he got rid of his first crew and put in a new crew that was more amenable to major tax cuts. he got rid of the guys who said, look, if you keep doing these tax cuts and tax cuts and tax cuts, you're going to put us in a bad situation here in the U.S., and it's going to be hard on the global economy, too. He got rid of those guys, and he got in some new guys who were going to be supportive of his tax cuts. Now he's getting rid of that crew because they, I think, are trying to tell him, look, you got to do something besides tax cuts, and he's trying to get in a new crew that will put through even more cuts. You know, the Alan Greenspan has been lecturing him, look, you got to deal with the deficit because of this whole problem of the global trade balance. And his old crew of economic advisors were saying, look, you got to listen to Alan Greenspan. I think he's looking for a new crew who can explain things a little bit better and tell him that, yes, more tax cuts are a good idea. So obviously he doesn't understand what's going on in the global economy or in the U.S. economy. But there is somebody out there who does, and that's the Chinese government. They've been going around the world and making these bilateral trade agreements, doing things that they would never be allowed to do or be able to do if there were somebody intelligent in the White House who actually understood what's going on. And by that, I'm talking about APEC. We didn't discuss the APEC conference a whole lot in the last couple of weeks when it was actually going on. But the Bush administration, George Bush, largely ignored APEC as anything but another opportunity to sit down and talk about terrorism. That was a major mistake, because the reason why the U.S. got involved in APEC in the first place was because they were interested in doing a region-wide economic bloc that could counter the European Union. That was supposed to be an Asia-Pacific economic bloc. They wanted to put together this group of Asian nations and Latin American nations all along the Asia-Pacific rim and see that as some kind of a counterweight to the European Union. That's pretty much gone by the wayside. The country that's taken the most advantage of the APEC bloc is China. They spent the whole 2 weeks before the end of the APEC conference, Hu Jintao, the Chinese premier, toured all of Latin America, toured all of South America, and he cut some very good deals with the Argentinian government, with the government of Brazil, the two main economies of South America, and some would argue the two fastest-growing economies in the Western Hemisphere, Argentina and Brazil. He cut some very major and profitable deals with them, and he was searching out sources for oil, cheaper sources for oil, and long-term oil contracts with countries that have traditionally been major suppliers to the United States. And the Bush administration just sat there and did nothing. George Bush spent no time, almost no time, down in South America prior to the end of the APEC conference. He flew down for the last couple of days to shake hands and talk about terrorism. And his lame duck State Department person, Colin Powell, was down there. But what can Colin Powell do on his own when you've got the Chinese premier, Hu Jintao, cutting these deals directly with Argentina and Brazil? So that was a major mistake that the Bush administration made. They're letting these things happen that the Clinton administration would never let happen, that even George Bush Sr. would never have allowed. At the same time, this last week, China has cut a major deal with Southeast Asian nations, the ASEAN, A-S-E-A-N group of nations, smaller economies mostly, including economies like Cambodia and Vietnam, but also some big weights in Southeast Asia like Singapore and Taiwan. Those folks sat down and signed a trade pact deal with China, which is major news. China and Japan and South Korea are looking to put together a trade bloc similar to the European Union in Asia that is not going to include anybody from North America. It's not going to include the United States. That's something you never would have seen under Clinton, but we're seeing it now under the Bush administration because of their isolationist policy, their focus on the war on terrorism and the Middle East, and their inability and unwillingness to do any kind of diplomacy, any kind of negotiation. And the fact, too, that George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney just don't understand economics and don't think that it's important for some reason. So China's taking advantage of that, and we'll see where China, Japan, and South Korea come out of all of this. We may actually find that between the European Union and the up-and-coming Asian Union that the United States empire might fall by the wayside if this continues.
Okay. Well, that moves us on to This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
The big news this week in Iraq has to do with the run-up to the elections. The Sunni groups have called for a delay in the elections, but that's not going to happen, according to the Iraqi interim government and George W. Bush. Now, Ayad Alawi, the interim prime minister, and his party, the Iraqi National Accord, were briefly part of a coalition that called for a delay a little more than a week ago. And briefly, the two main Kurdish groups had joined in on that call for a delay. And then the Shiites balked. They said, look, we want the elections to happen on time. They pointed out that the interim constitution would have to be amended in order to delay the elections, since the constitution calls for elections by January 2005. And then the Shiites threatened to create their own autonomous region in the south of Iraq, similar to what the Kurds have in the north of Iraq. And Ayad Alawi caved in, and his party said, okay, we'll have elections on time. The Kurds also changed their minds, because as soon as the Shiites said, look, you have to amend the constitution, the Kurds said, no, don't touch the constitution, because the interim constitution has a clause in it that allows the Kurds to do something that no other group in the country can do, and that's to veto the permanent constitution when it's drafted and voted on next year. That clause says that if three provinces in Iraq have a two-thirds majority that votes against the constitution, then they have to go back to the drawing board and redraft it. And the Kurds control three provinces, so it gives them a veto power over even though they're a 20% minority in the country, it gives them a veto over the new constitution. So the Kurds don't want to lose that controversial clause that the Shiites have objected to. So they don't want anybody to touch the draft they don't want anybody sitting down saying, let's amend the interim constitution. So they said, okay, we'll have elections on time. Now, just to remind folks, the elections are for a 275-seat assembly that will draft a new constitution for Iraq that will then be voted on by the entire population. And if it's approved, then there will be actual elections. Supposedly, the timeline is December of 2005. The permanent elections for a permanent assembly, not the interim assembly to draft the permanent constitution. That's what the January elections are for. The December 2005 elections are supposed to be for a permanent assembly and for a prime minister. Now, the Shiites are the majority population in Iraq. They're about 60% of the country. 20% of the country are the Kurds, Kurdish minority, and 20% are Sunni Arabs, with a sprinkling of Turks and a few other very small minority groups in between there. Now, Ayad Alawi went to Jordan this past week to try and get a few of the moderate Sunni groups, mostly his buddies, to join in the elections, because he doesn't want a full Sunni boycott. He wants to get at least some folks to collaborate and join in the elections. But there was no serious discussion with any of the rebel leaders, and there won't be. In spite of pressure from Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Syria, those three neighboring countries do not want to see a Shiite government because they're worried about Iranian influence on their borders. There's a scenario here that no one is discussing, and that scenario is if all of the Sunnis do boycott the elections, you could have something like an 80 to 85% majority Shiite government. Now, that is going to intensify the civil war. If you have a government that is totally dominated by the Shiites, and if you have complete disenfranchisement of the Sunni population, the problem with that in intensifying civil war is that the rebels could then get backing from Saudi Arabia and other neighboring states, including Jordan, or from private individuals, wealthy private individuals in those nations who want to fight against a totally Shiite-dominated government. That's a true Vietnam scenario that we haven't seen so far in Iraq. We've seen rebels who the U.S. government suspects are getting some support from abroad, but can't really prove it. They can't really name the individuals who are financing. They think it might be a few of Saddam Hussein's former Ba'ath Party officials who stashed money abroad or took money abroad when the war was just starting. That's going to be limited funding compared to what could happen if you have the government of Saudi Arabia, for example, under the table financing the rebels in Iran, or if you have wealthy Saudi individuals or Kuwaiti individuals or folks from Jordan funding the rebel movement. Then you'll start to see not just improvised explosive devices and rocket and RPGs and that sort of thing. You're going to start seeing some really truly heavy weaponry and a real quagmire that looks a lot like Vietnam. In the meantime, Shiite groups are trying to develop a unified slate of candidates, but secular Shiites are complaining that it's heavily dominated by religious parties. The Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which has ties to Iran, and the Dawah Party, which is a religious party that has ties to the West, particularly the CIA and State Department, and Muqtada al-Sadr's group. He's also considered a religious party since he considers himself a religious cleric. And most of his followers are for a conservative religious movement. Those folks are the candidates that dominate the Shiite list are mostly from those three parties. Negotiations are continuing on the list that they're going to put forward to sit in the assembly because the secular Shiites are nervous about the number of religious party candidates. Absent from the Shiite list is Ayad Alawi, who the current prime minister, who is himself a Shiite, but his party, the Iraqi National Accord, is made up mostly of former exiles, many of whom are former Ba'ath Party officials, and a lot of them are Sunnis. So it's possible that Ayad Alawi could be a loser in the January elections and not be even sitting on the assembly, much less a candidate for president. The two Kurdish parties will present their own list of candidates, but Ayad Alawi is trying to get them on his side so that he can put forth a list of candidates that includes his name. He's going to try maybe to have a coalition with the Kurds. Once the election occurs and the 275 seats are filled on the National Assembly, that assembly will then pick a president. But the leading candidates for president are, it's turning out, to be mostly the Shiite religious figures, like the head of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq and the Dawah Party are the main candidates right now. Voter registration, in the meantime, has been rough. It's been very rough. There are three provinces where it hasn't even begun, three Sunni provinces. It's only been spotty in the capital of Baghdad. In other provinces as well, there have been problems, like in Karbala province, in the city of Amara, in the region south of Baghdad, not just in Sunni areas, but in other areas too. It's been difficult for them to get the registration process going. Registration is supposed to end just 11 days from now, so we'll see. A delay in the elections would be a good idea, but the Bush administration is pushing for it to happen right away. So we'll see. In the meantime, the city of Fallujah. Oh, Mike is waving for me to wrap up, so I'll just say, okay, that's it for this week in Iraq, and we can discuss some of this other stuff next week.
All right. With that, we're out of time. Talking once again with Maria Tomchik, co-editor at Eat the State. And quickly, where can people find Eat the State?
You can find Eat the State in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes. We're a newspaper that comes out about every other week. It's free. Pick it up around town if you see it. If you can't find the print version, you can find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org. That's eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer or you want to donate, we are having our year-end fundraising drive right now. You can give us a call at 903-9461. And you can donate from our website. We have a PayPal button on there. And we are trying to go for about a $6,000. That's our goal for donations. And we're hoping that you will remember us in your end-of-the-year contributions.